Hey, everybody. It's your friendly neighborhood podcast host. It's Mike, on vacation this week, at least from the day job, from the radio. But I thought we'd do one of these anyway, because why not? You seem to like them. Thank you for the emails, by the way. Somebody wrote in the subject line, I've got compliments. And at first, of course, I read that as I've got complaints and thought, oh, man, here we go. But it turned out a lot better than I thought. For today, something different. It's our first quick questions, topics that maybe aren't the full 8, 9, 10 minutes on their own, but that we should still get answers to. And the first one, it starts here. This is from a town square in Nice, France. Kind of fits with the vacation theme because I was there last year. And this part of Nice, it looks really nice in the pictures. And I say that because I don't really remember this particular moment. But I guess I liked the bell, so I recorded it. And thing is, I don't remember because of jet lag. I had just gotten there. I was pretty fuzzy, which, sad, because you want to remember your vacations. So what is jet lag? Can we lessen the effects? Does everybody get it? Do pilots get it? This is where I usually say, I've got questions and the theme plays, but we already did that, so let's just ask one.
I usually like to do transcon flights out of Los Angeles. A lot of times we're going to the East Coast, so New York, Boston, Dallas, Newark.
Captain Laura Einsettler, commercial pilot for a major U.S. airline, flying more than 20 years and changing time zones a lot. So perfect for this one.
Well, I think people think that we're immune to it somehow, but it definitely affects us as well. We might be a little bit more well prepared. Jet lag is usually caused because of your circadian rhythm disruption. As you're changing time zones and you're going opposite schedules of when you should be sleeping, when you should be awake, we just feel messed up, right?
100%. And then there's the things that make it worse.
Dehydration. Up at altitude, the aircraft is usually about a 4% humidity range. And then also there's less oxygen pressure because normally we're up at 8,000 feet. Cabin altitude. It's like hiking at an 8,000 foot mountain or something.
So take all that, add it up, and you can see why it happens. And if you have any doubt still lingering that it's a real thing, why don't we ask a doctor?
You know, you can't just will your way out of it. It's a physiologic process, and it happens to some extent to everyone.
I'd like you to meet Dr. Vernon Williams, the director of the Center of Sports Neurology and Pain Medicine at the Curlin Job Institute.
As a sports neurologist, one of the ways we look at it is performance. Pretty much every way you slice it, you can find support for this concept that performance declines if you haven't slept well. And performance declines when you're suffering from some kind of jet lag. And it's pretty clear that if you're crossing more than two time zones, you have a significant reduction in your likelihood of winning a game.
So what do we do?
I mean, one, you have to kind of accept that, okay, this is going to happen. It's going to take some days for your body to adjust to the new time.
They actually say it takes about a day to recover for each time zone that you cross.
But also it's a strategy.
And here's strategy number one, which is don't really change.
You know, if you're staying within 1 to 3 hour time zone change and it's less than, you know, a 4 or 5 day trip, let's say, you want to try to stay on your same sleep and eating cycles.
But if that's not an option, let's try strategy two.
You really want to just every day kind of swing your normal sleeping and eating times by a couple of hours.
And that's when you get there or before you even leave.
If possible, people can start to shift their bodies. So if they know they're going to be 2 or 3 or 4 time zones away, they may shift their sleep time a little bit.
Yeah, change your wake up time, change your bedtime to get a little bit closer to where you're going. And then when you get there, let's say you land in the middle of the afternoon, but you're dead tired, you got to try and stay awake. It does help if you sleep when you're supposed to be sleeping via the new clock and then wake up the next morning and get out there in the sun, because this is all about reprogramming your body. And the sunlight is going to do that the best.
Early exposure before 10 or 11 a.m. can help with respect to your brain setting that melatonin release appropriately.
You're on vacation anyways, so take yourself out to breakfast, eat outside, and then go for a walk. And we walk because we need to get our 10,000 steps, right? How's that for a segue? You ever wonder where that came from? 10,000 steps a day? There is a story behind it. And it starts in 1960s Japan.
Japan at the time was really growing economically and was becoming an industrialized country. You know, this is the time of cars and bullet trains, but also the time of more desk jobs and less physical activity.
Dr. Tom Harai, director of the Bariatric and Metabolic Health Center at O'Connor Hospital in San Jose.
There was this company called Yamasa. This doctor expressed his concerns about, you know, the way things were going with society and how the lifestyle was changing and how that could impact negatively on people's health. So he actually asked this company president to make a device that could track steps. So it took 2 years to get ready. And in 1965, he was ready to sell it. And he wanted to come up with a catchy name. And the name he came with was the Manpo Meter. Man means 10,000 and Po means steps. So it was literally the 10,000 step meter.
So here we are, or there we were, at a place that was one part health and one part marketing. But how many steps do you really need a day? How many should you get?
If you really drill down, Mike, a little bit into the data, you find that you don't necessarily have to get the 10,000. But if you strive towards that, you know, kind of like you strive towards the moon, maybe you kind of land amongst the stars type of situation.
I love that. Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford's obesity medicine at Massachusetts General and Harvard Med.
If you look at studies, 7 or 8,000 seems to be just as beneficial as 10,000.
Basically, the idea is get enough that maintains your current weight. And that, depending on strides and speed and all that, is usually about 5 miles. So get towards that. Bottom line, lots of people don't get anywhere near this, and we're just sitting too much.
Exactly. And I think that's the key thing is like that we need to aim towards movement. A lot of us have become very sedentary, right? Like we live in front of our computers. We spend our time on social media, on our smartphones, et cetera. And movement is just kind of like an afterthought. Like we don't really have to move. We can press a few buttons. Our groceries can be there. Our dinner can be there. We really don't have to do anything. So we just need to be moving. We need to do it. We don't have to go out and hunt and gather like our ancestors did, but we still need to be moving and we need to be purposeful in our movement.
And look, you can piece this together easily enough, ways to do it. She says the easiest one is just to build it in as parts of your routine every day.
When I was a resident, I don't know what my the junior residents and medical students thought about me, but I would start our rounds in the basement and I would have us walk up the stairs to the 12th floor from the basement. And I had very little empathy for them because I was older than they were and I wore 5-inch heels. So I figured if I can do it, you can do
you
it.
Can you can know? Too. No excuses, right? All right. We've got one more thing for today.
Hi, Mike. I'd love to know origins of some of our common idiomatic expressions like nose to the grindstone, raining cats and dogs, hold your horses. Hey, love the podcast. Mike Amore, Cheshire, Connecticut.
Mike, you've got a great voice, and we can do that.
My name is Jay Padgett, and I'm a professor at UC Santa Cruz.
And he is in linguistics.
To be an idiom, you have to be a phrase or a sentence, not just a word. The meaning is not composed out of the parts. That's non-compositional.
They are a curiosity for guys like him, and they do come with a warning.
It's just buyer beware. So often you get multiple stories, and I don't believe most of them.
That being said, let's go. Raining cats and dogs.
You know, the most gruesome one is that, you know, maybe in the Middle Ages, literally, we would see cats and dogs sort of floating in the water in the street during thunderstorms.
Well, this is certainly taking a turn.
But some sources say, well, it comes from superstitions. Witches made storms happen. Cats are associated with witches. I think the truth is that we have no idea.
Fair enough. For hold your horses, it's easy enough. In the days of carriages, you weren't ready yet. You had to hold your horses. And nose to the grindstone. Kind of like that.
It's sort of easier to get the metaphor, at least once somebody explains to you what the heck a grindstone is. But grindstones were these big stones that would turn so that you could sharpen a knife or some other tool on it. Keeping someone's nose to the grindstone meant not keeping them working without a break.
And if that happens, you might get mad at your boss. But do you eventually bury the hatchet?
Yeah. So people will always talk about Native Americans, and they'll say that it was a custom for certain Indians to bury a hatchet as a symbol of making peace. So that may be true, but it's not clear that that's where we get this idiom, because there are references to hanging up hatchets and burying hatchets that go back hundreds of more years.
I've got more of these, but I think we'll wait till the next quick questions when we do volume 2. You're hearing sounds right now from a bar. I think next week we'll go out drinking. So in the meantime, send me some more questions, more topics. I've got questions at audacy.com, AUDACY. And new episodes on Thursdays.